rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times, in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal: to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
This episode of Politics Without the Boring Bits is sponsored by BT, because BT means business. BT knows that businesses come in many shapes, sizes, and guises, from the person just starting out at their kitchen table to the biggest employer, which is why no matter what line of work you're in, they've got your back to help you succeed and do what you do best. No doubt connectivity is a must in Westminster, and it certainly helped us to get this episode created and distributed to you listening right now. BT already connects more than 1 million businesses and public sector organisations, offering secure and reliable connectivity. Nearly three quarters of people running a business or side hustle feel they couldn't do so without reliable broadband and mobile connectivity. That's why having connectivity you can count on is a must for business, whether it be facilitating multiple devices being connected at once, or making team calls or guest Wi-Fi access for customers. BT's connectivity helps keep you and your customers happy. Whatever your business, BT's got your back. Search BT's got your back.
Hello, you're listening to the Red Box Politics Podcast. I'm Patrick Maguire, sitting in for Matt Chorley on this Bank Holiday Monday. We've got a great episode for you today, if I do say so myself. Of course, we've been talking a lot about the next Prime Minister. Who's going to win the Tory leadership race? Who's going to be in their cabinet? And will that really include John Redwood? But what about the loser? I took a look at history's political losers and what Rishi Sunak or Liz Truss might learn from them once we know the result, as they're banished to the backbenches. Lots to learn there, but as ever, we have our columnist panel first. Today is Libby Purvis and Rachel Cunliffe.
The Columnists on Times Radio.
But now it's time for our favourite part of the show, our all-star columnist panel. It's time to talk to some of the best names in the business. And today we have Libby Purvis from The Times. Morning, Libby.
Morning.
And Rachel Cunliffe from The New Statesman. Morning, Rachel.
Good morning.
How are you both doing this morning? How are you doing, Libby?
I've just been doing the cat's worm medicine, so it's better to be doing this,
and,
frankly.
And they told you Fleet Street would be all glamour, Libby. And Rachel, how's your bank holiday been so far?
Well, my cat just tried to eat the phone that I'm using to record this. So. Do
we just want to make this some sort of feline counselling session?
I think so, yeah.
Oh dear. Right, let's get into it, shall we? We could talk about cats all morning. I'm sure I'm not a cat fan, so I'll keep my opinions to myself to prevent myself from upsetting you. Let's instead talk, Rachel, about the column you've picked out this morning. Not one of yours, but from Charlotte Ivers in the Sunday Times yesterday. Are we failing the young in this country? I saw this this column got a lot of love on Twitter. Charlotte Ivers, a similar age to me, actually. Talking about how lots of 20-somethings are looking at Britain, dysfunctional in their view, and concluding that they shouldn't do the conventional thing of working hard, saving to buy a house, climbing the professional sort of greasy pole, because the rewards that were there for previous generations, in Charlotte's view, aren't there anymore. Hello, Rachel.
Oh. Oh, hello. Yes, it's not just in her view. It's a trend that's kind of been widely written about. But when people do write about it, the response is, "Oh, entitled young people who want to be handed everything." And then you look at the numbers and quite how stark the situation she's sort of describing is. The idea that you can be earning comparatively a really high salary, so over 40,000, over 50,000, you can be a couple earning that, and your chance of being able to buy a house, start a family, kind of grow up in that sense, has been completely decimated. So kind of what's the point? And if you've got lots of professionals in sectors like banking or law or even the civil service who are going, yeah, I could work really hard, but I'm never going to be able to achieve those things because the housing market's completely broken. My student loan repayments mean that I'm paying a marginal tax rate of over 50%. Childcare in this country is outrageously expensive. So basically, what's the point? And you check out of the system, it doesn't really bode well. Now, I imagine there's not going to be much sympathy for this for people outside of that generation. But what I would say is if even that class of kind of middle-class professionals are feeling this despondent about the state of the country, it doesn't really inspire much hope about where we could be going forward.
Well, Libby, do you sympathise with the case that young people are getting a raw deal from politics and the economy in Britain today, or should they stop moaning?
I absolutely sympathise with what Charlotte says. And what I love is the fact that we're starting to get young writers, columnists from something seen as the right, you know, something seen as not the lefty wing media, pointing this out and saying this. And what is fascinating is the idea that the Conservatives think they can ever win an election again with these young voters. I mean, we have had a decade and more of Conservative government. It hasn't fixed the NHS, hasn't fixed a broken house market, power security, hasn't levelled up deprived areas. Look at Ed Lucas this morning. We are still, you know, an absolute haven for dirty foreign money from dodgy regimes and dodgy people and their dodgy lawyers. It's absolutely filthy. Even Conservative commentators are fed up and starting to call for things like renationalising energy, as they are on the front of the paper today, who wouldn't vote for change? And I think the idea that politicians have simply failed to see this and think they can carry on with the Boris style and Liz Truss style boosterism of this is a wonderful country and we are proud to be here and not look around them and see how things are, especially for the rising generation and especially regarding the housing market and our enormous gap, as see Edward Lucas again this morning, enormous gap of wealth and income, you know, that so many families have absolutely no savings or tiny little savings and are going to be hit hard this winter. There has to be some kind of change. And I'm very encouraged that the young of the middle class and potentially right wing are starting to say, oi, this won't do.
Rachel, what do you think? You know, Liz Truss will be, or Rishi Sunak when they arrive in number 10, on Monday, what can they do? You know, they'll be reading columns like Charlotte's. They'll be reading columns like Robert Colville's in the Sunday Times yesterday. He made a very similar argument, talking about how actually, if you look at the economic privileges and the marginal tax rate a worker who's 60 will enjoy compared to a worker on the same salary who's 25. You know, the numbers speak for themselves. What could they do on day one to, you know, win over commentators like Charlotte and Robert, or, you know, just to address this problem? What are the practical, constructive things that they can do?
The number one thing that would help, it wouldn't fix everything, that would help, would be liberalising the planning system and building more houses, building on brownfield, building family homes, flats, satellite cities, cities around, sort of rethinking about the greenbelt land, which is not always lovely green rolling fields. A lot of it is kind of disused car parks and brownfield sites that have been designated green, and just making sure that those projects actually happen. The issue is, I don't think either of them, either Liz Truss or Rishi Sunak, will do that, because we've had 12 years of Conservative politicians who actually do believe ideologically that it would be great if we had more housing, but then sort of come up against acute NIMBYism.
Well,
when
Boris
they
Johnson
try.
And tried to do it, of course, and it was...
He tried it, and there was sort of widespread opposition to it, and I think this is articulated beautifully, sorry to single her out, but by the MP Maria Caulfield, who is a Conservative junior minister, who will happily tweet pictures of herself in fields saying, I'm so excited, I helped block this initiative, this horrible initiative that would have enabled, you know, all of these families to have homes on this lovely, lovely, lovely dirty green field that isn't being used for everything. She's also done it as well with a solar farm, not like we're in an energy crisis or anything. And I think as long as that's possible, as long as local residents have the power to put that much pressure on their MPs, NIMBYism to block things and to say, well, we're quite happy with our houses now, so we don't actually want anyone else living near us. As long as they have that power, nothing is going to get built. So I think we should actually reframe house building as something patriotic. And if you really love your country and you really believe in the future of Britain and productivity and growth and the next generation having the opportunities that you did, maybe sacrifice a tiny bit of your view so that a young family can get a home. Otherwise, you're not really patriotic at all. I'm sorry, you're just selfish.
What do you reckon, Libby?
Well, and tax. Can I just say, I mean, I agree with a lot of that, but I will also say and tax. Basically, the triple lock on pensions, certainly for the most affluent, is not appropriate. I draw my pension now simply because it is a way of giving quite a lot of it away and forcing the government to give 25% gift aid on top of it. It's absurd. We need higher taxes on the richest, on the most affluent, and the idea that they'll all sort of flee overseas. I mean, most just can't, you know, because their work and lives are here. No, we need a massive levelling up, and this doesn't have to be sort of Corbynite socialism. But there's absolutely the blindness of the Conservative Party the last 12 years to this has been astonishing, and Tony Blair didn't do that much good before either.
Rachel, do you have any faith when you look at both contenders that they are alive to these challenges? Or, you know, it's interesting what you just said, you know, Tory MPs who know deep down ideologically that all the answers to these questions are at their fingertips, but they don't have the incentive to do it. They're pitching towards a Tory membership that's older and lives in the shires, perhaps, you know. They're never going to be rewarded, particularly at this stage in the race. You know, who knows what they'll do when they get into office, whether they'll, you know, tack towards these constructive solutions. But they're never going to be rewarded in moments like these, are they, for saying unpopular things to their membership?
No, I think they have this very clear idea that older people vote and they are more likely to vote Conservative, and they are so panicked about whether or not they'll win the next election, that that's what they're focusing on. And I think there's this mythology in the Conservative Party that people naturally become more Conservative, more likely to vote Tory as they get older. So it doesn't matter if young people today don't support them, because, you know, eventually they'll get older and they will. And I think what's missing from that analysis is if you deny people the opportunities of adulthood, of owning a home, of starting a family, of putting down roots, of not spending 50% of your income renting a room in a dodgy house share, if you don't give people that chance, that sort of transition, why would they vote for you? So I think the next election they'll probably be okay because of the way the age demographics work, but not to sound too harsh, but eventually those older voters are not going to be voting anymore, and they are not being replaced at the moment, and I think that's an existential challenge for the Tory party.
Hang on. As an older voter, can I just actually weigh in here? I am 72 years old, and I am as furious as anybody, and so are a great mass of my friends and people of my own age. We can see the problem. We can see what's wrong. We absolutely agree with this. The idea that, you know, there's these older people who are all Conservative voters is just nonsense. And I hope that an awful lot of them are going to give a seriously bloody nose to the party at the next election. You know, I don't know whether Labour will be a good government or not, but if the Conservatives really deserve something, it is a big slap from my generation.
Is the problem not broader than the Conservatives? Is it not a problem, Rachel, with our political culture more generally, that not terribly good at thinking about things in the long term? Because long term, be it infrastructure projects, be it big structural changes to how this country works, tend to involve a bit of pain, and they are unpopular. So no government, unless they have a massive majority, is able to make these structural changes. And even when Boris Johnson won his landslide in 2019, he couldn't do stuff like planning reform because Tory MPs kicked up a massive fuss, and all the promise of that 80-seat majority for big structural lasting change very, very quickly evaporated.
I think there definitely is some of that, not just with the Conservatives either. There's that video of, I think, Ed Davey when he was in the coalition government with Cameron and Nick Clegg, both talking about how they weren't going to authorise sort of extra fracking sites and nuclear power stations and things back in 2012 that would have helped secure Britain's national energy security in 10 years' time. Well, 10 years' time is now. If they'd made those decisions now, OK, they still wouldn't be in government, but we also wouldn't be facing the energy crisis that we are at the moment. So I think there is sort of an issue with thinking long term and strategically, and that is kind of across the political spectrum, all parties, all governments. Countries that do it well, that are good at building long term infrastructure projects, often have another mechanism, another institution of government that's a bit more long term, sort of citizens' assemblies or some kind of institution that is set up in order to have a long-term political goal, and that is what pushes it through, not the politicians who are elected day to day, because they are always going to be thinking in 4 or 5 year cycles, not in 10 years, 20 years. And I think one of the reasons we are in such a wretched position looking into this autumn and winter is because of a failure to make decisions that seemed politically unpopular a decade ago, but actually in hindsight of absolutely what we should have done.
Do you agree, Libby? Are politicians too quick to kick cans down the road?
Absolutely, always have been. But all the same, there is a responsibility on them. These are responsible jobs. They have to look at the long term. Sometimes they have to give up a bit of cheap popularity for long-term thinking. And it has happened at times in the past history. It should be happening again. I have more faith in, if I have faith in any of them, I have more faith in Sunak than I do in Liz Truss, because he has shown in all the things he's said that he is willing to look more widely and further ahead and do the hard sums better than she is. But he's not going to win, is he?
That was Rachel Cunliffe and Libby Purvis going head-to-head on the issue of intergenerational fairness. Fascinating discussion there. You can read Libby in The Times, of course. Just get yourself a subscription. Up next, we're talking losers in British politics.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
You're listening to the Times Redbox Politics Podcast. Now it's time for this.
The Big Thing on Times Radio.
Yes, this time next week, we'll at last have learned the outcome of the Tory leadership race. And if the polls and Conservative MPs are to be believed, Liz Truss is going to be the one who's on her way to meet the Queen. But what's going to happen to Rishi Sunak, or indeed Liz Truss, if the polls are wrong? And the opposite result is the one we get next Monday. Humbled by their colleagues, will they be on their way to the cabinet in a junior role or a senior role? Will they be going to the backbenches, or will they be leaving politics altogether? Will Rishi Sunak be heading back to the beaches of Santa Monica? Well, last week, Rishi Sunak, the man who it's widely assumed will not be winning this leadership election, told the BBC that despite rumours to the contrary, he plans to stay put.
No, absolutely not. Of course not, and I would dispute the characterisation. Right, I'm working incredibly hard, going around the country, talking about my ideas for the future, and actually having a very positive reception where I'm going. And I think there's everything left to play for. There's still weeks to run in this campaign, and that's why I'm continuing to give it everything I've got.
Well, history, of course, is written by the victors. Unless you're answering the trivia question on this show, those who run for the top job and then lose are sometimes forgotten, shafted by posterity. Others, however, end up leaving just as big a mark on their parties and politics at Westminster as the politicians who beat them. So today, as Sunak and his supporters contemplate their future in government, or out of politics altogether, we're asking what kind of a loser he might be, what kind of a loser Liz Truss might be, and how others in Westminster over the past six decades have shown that missing out in a leadership election need not be the end. Now, joining me to talk through all of this is a man who's seen most of the people we're going to be talking about in action up close, Phil Webster, former political editor of The Times. Good morning, Phil.
Good morning.
Now, let's start back in the 1960s, which is just before your working career as a journalist, Phil, but some of the players did stick around after that. We'll start with the very, very first contested Tory leadership election, 1965. Ted Heath won, Reggie Maudling came second, and in a very, very distant third was a maverick former minister by the name of Enoch Powell. If Heath thought that result was going to assert his authority over Powell, he was very much mistaken. Over the next decade, the pair became bitter, bitter rivals, and Powell seized every opportunity to undermine and destabilise his leader and prime minister. Most notably, of course, when he gave that infamous Rivers of Blood speech in 1968. Heath sacked him for that.
I dismissed Mr. Powell from the Shadow Cabinet because I believed that his speech was inflammatory and liable to damage race relations in this country. I am determined to do everything I can to prevent racial problems developing into civil strife. And this means that these questions must be treated with moderation and with toleration.
Here's Margaret Thatcher on why she thought it exploded in the way that it did.
I remember Ted ringing me up on Sunday morning because it was all over the Sunday papers saying Enoch must go. And I said, look, I would just wait and just read the whole speech and just think about it for a few days. No, he must go. Everyone says he must go. And I gathered later there would have been resignations from Shadow Cabinet if Enoch hadn't gone. I thought it was a conclusion jumped to far too rapidly if you looked at the logic and reason in his speech.
He was also a thorn in Ted Heath's side over Europe, so much so that he ended up endorsing the Labour Party in 1974.
Judas was paid! Judas was paid! I am making a sacrifice!
Yes, that was Enoch Powell endorsing Harold Wilson's Labour because they, unlike Ted Heath, were offering a referendum on Europe. Phil, Enoch Powell was the archetypal rebel, wasn't he? You know, never got the top job himself, so he took the nuclear option of, rather than lose and having to serve in the cabinet of a leader he thought was wrong about basically everything, he became a serial malcontent on the back benches, sowing discord and you know, taking that nuclear option and rebelling on every big question, didn't he?
Yeah, his was one of the sort of saddest departures in the sense that a top line politician was taken, really took himself off the scene for so long. And of course, the 1968 speech, although very controversial, was quite popular in the country at the time, and it was popular with quite a lot of his colleagues. Powell really believed that he should have the top job, and there was an element of calculation in making that speech. Of course, he didn't get it. He got sacked. And then advising voters to go for Labour was the ultimate sin, and certainly Margaret Thatcher would not have been able to support him any longer after that. He then, of course, he advised people to vote Labour. Some people think he was that might even have been a factor in Labour's victory, very narrow victory in February 74. Mm. And then in the October 74 election, there was Powell standing for the Ulster Unionists. He'd completely gone from the Tory party. He ended up really making good speeches from the backbenches for another 13 years after that, before he finally went. But really a wasted career.
But precisely because he was so unwilling to brook any compromise with his own quite idiosyncratic principles, wasn't he? And across the floor, another Eurosceptic, Tony Benn, played much the same role in the Labour Party. You know, under Harold Wilson, he'd been a technocratic modernising minister behind the Post Office Tower and Concord. But by the time he loses in 1976 in that leadership election Jim Callaghan won, he was veering left and, as far as his colleagues were concerned, veering off the reservation. Here's Roy Hattersley on his evolution as a politician.
A number of factors made it possible for demagogues, by demagogues I principally mean Tony Benn, to say this is what is wrong with the Labour Party. Your leaders betray you. Your leaders are really Tories in disguise. Policy is never genuine socialism. It's always capitalism dressed up to look like something different. The Labour Party for 2 or 3 years wasn't an opposition at all. It was an opposition to itself. There was an internal opposition. There was a civil war in the very real sense of that terms.
And here's another lifelong rebel, or rather a you know, someone, an apostate almost, Phil, who goes from being a minister of the top rank, perhaps more senior than Enoch Powell was as a minister, and becoming a rabble-rouser, a demagogue, as Roy Hattersley put it, and opposing the leadership of his own party every turn.
Yeah, I mean, Ben was a great parliamentarian, and he had almost 50 years in the House of Commons. But he, too, wanted to be leader and thought he should be leader. And he realised his only way of becoming leader was on the back of the left. Mm. So, yes, he lost in 76, but probably even more famously, he lost in 1981 when he stood up against Dennis Healey for the deputy leadership election, and Healey beat him narrowly. Had Ben won that election, politics would have been a lot different, I think. He would then have been in prime position to become leader later on. But from that moment on, he was a malcontent. We still got the wonderful speeches in the Commons. He was good to listen to, as was Powell, of course. Entertained a lot of us who had to spend our lives reporting politics. But he was going to go nowhere. He stood a couple of times for the leadership after then and got totally derisory votes.
And in 1988, he challenged Kinnock, didn't he? And was absolutely crushed.
He did. And he later had a go, I think, against Blair, which was just a nominal challenge. But and he got hardly any votes at all. But he enjoyed himself. And he was, in his way, he was quite Hattersley is right in what he represented. He wasn't liked by the leadership, but he was quite popular with MPs on both sides.
And that's, we're seeing a common theme emerging here. It's people, once they look at top office, Powell in 1965, then when 68, the leadership didn't fall into his lap after Rivers of Blood. You're looking at Ben, 76, 81, 88, they're not getting the top job. So they sort of start to plough their own furrow. They find an appreciative audience elsewhere. So let's stick with Labour then. There is another option, of course, rather than finding a niche in Westminster, becoming a backbench malcontent, you can just leave altogether. You'll remember, Phil, Brian Gould, who was a bright young thing, who lost out to John Smith in 1992. And then before long, he left for New Zealand and left British politics entirely, didn't he?
Yeah, well, strange case of Brian Gould. He born in New Zealand, came over here, got a first class degree at Oxford, and then tried to take over the Labour Party. He failed. He stood against John Smith in the 92 election. Very soon afterwards thought, well, I'll go back to New Zealand. I failed in that bid to take over Britain. I'll go back to New Zealand. He became Vice Chancellor of the University of Waikato. I should add here, not many people know this, that Brian's brother Wayne is credited with popularising Sudoku. I don't know if you know that, Patrick.
I was very dimly aware of that. You have reminded me of that. They have. He left a much more consequential mark on British public life and British papers than his brother Brian did. But more famous still, on the subject of brothers, is David Miliband, of course.
Because I think I can make a difference. I came into politics to make a difference, and now I'm leaving British politics to make a difference on the international level through a charity rather than through a government.
That was David Miliband explaining why he quit British politics, quit Parliament in 2013. Phil, you were right in the thick of it during this period. Ed Miliband did want David Miliband on his front bench when he unexpectedly won the leadership. He wanted to make him Shadow Chancellor, didn't he? But David said no. Was it obvious from the word go that David Miliband was going to leave politics? Was this just a case of David being unwilling to swallow his pride? Or obviously they had fundamental disagreements over how the Labour Party should work. But was there ever, as far as you could see it, covering it this all from Westminster at the time, was it just a case of when, not if, David was going to leave politics?
Oh, yeah, I think from the moment. I mean, David thought he was going to win and he was overconfident. Those of us who sort of followed the Kremlinology of it all at the time, had David promised on the quiet that Ed Balls would have been his chancellor or shadow chancellor in opposition or government, I don't think Ed Miliband would have won. But he wouldn't do that. He didn't want to make a deal with Ed Balls at that time. Gordon Brown in the background didn't want David Miliband to win. He wanted Ed Miliband to win, despite the fact that Ed Balls had worked for him all this time. Mm. So when the result came and he lost by a sliver, there was no way that David could stay with Ed, because he knew rightly that from day one, we would all have been writing stories, and they would have been genuine, true stories about differences with his brother. So he hung about on the back benches for a couple of years and then went off to the International Rescue Committee. And he stayed there for a long, long time. But he, in my opinion, and it was a great loss to the Labour Party at the time. I think he would have done better than his brother at leading it. And I think what the outcome in 2015 might well have been different if David had been leading the Labour Party. We'll never know that. But I understood his decision. It wasn't only pride. I think it was a knowledge that if he stayed on, Ed's life would be impossible and it would be very difficult for the Labour Party.
Yeah, he was in a uniquely invidious position, not only disagreeing with the course that the Labour Party was charting, but it, being his younger brother, that's a situation totally without parallel in British political history, isn't it? And so now we're looking at people who look at Westminster, look at the situation in their own parties and think, you know, you might be Brian Gould and think, well, British politics has nothing left for me if I don't have the top job. You might be David Miliband looking at the situation thinking, well, this is a total nightmare. Or you might be Andy Burnham.
I got very frustrated in Westminster. I fell out of love with the place. You know, the way it works, it kind of, I think it makes a fraud out of people in that it makes people say things they don't fully believe in. It makes them vote in ways they don't kind of fully feel. And consequently, you know, people end up, I think, getting lost in the Westminster system. And that happened to me to some degree. So when you come back to a role like this and you can kind of rediscover what you're all about and you don't give that up lightly.
So Andy Burnham, of course, Phil, ran for Labour leadership twice in 2010, came a distant fourth there, didn't he? And then 2015, he was very much the favourite, but somehow lost to Jeremy Corbyn. And had an unhappy couple of years on Jeremy Corbyn's front bench, but then in 2017 was elected the Mayor of Greater Manchester and has enjoyed this great late career renaissance as the so-called King of the North. And it's interesting, Andy Burnham had an escape route that other politicians before him didn't have, in that the devolution settlement gave him a big job, gave him a platform that he could then build an alternative power base rather than languishing on the back benches or making unhappy compromises and serving under other Labour leaders, didn't he?
Yeah, Andy did well in the end out of failing in those two leadership elections, and I suppose most people would think he's done a solid job as Mayor of Manchester. Interestingly, of course, when Keir Starmer was facing a potential fine over Partygate matters, there was talk then of bringing Andy back. Of course, he couldn't come back in those circumstances, because he wasn't an MP under the rules that govern it. But he's one of those MPs, one of those leadership figures who'd gone off and made a much bigger name for himself by being out of Westminster. And there, I imagine his example will be followed by others. There are more and more mayor elections now taking place. And I think that may be an escape route for a lot more politicians, Labour as well as Conservative in the future. Who knows what will happen after this particular leadership election going on now.
And finally, just before we discuss the future, as you say, Phil, there is another option, apparently. We don't see this very often, and that's staying loyal. And that's what Rishi Sunak insists he's going to do, but we'll discuss that more in just a moment. Let's listen to one rebellious leader in waiting, that perhaps the most famous of them all, ultimately ended up.
I have been asked to reply.
Madam Deputy Speaker, this is an historic moment. May I welcome the Right Honourable Gentleman to his first Prime Minister's questions. It's been a long time, but he's finally made it.
I'm most grateful to the Right Honourable Gentleman for his welcome to my position at the dispatch box today.
Well, that, of course, is Michael Heseltine doing PMQs, because he ended his frontline career as John Major's loyal deputy. Of course, he was partly constrained by health problems that ultimately meant he couldn't run again for the Tory leadership after unsuccessfully challenging Margaret Thatcher in 1990. He had a heart attack, of course. But in the end, Phil, you know, he's a man of great thwarted ambition, but was he a good and faithful and loyal servant to John Major in the end?
He was. I mean, I paired with Michael Heseltine on another timed radio show just recently, and he made the point there, which was quite right, that he, Douglas Hurd and Major had fought that 90 contest in a way, in a civilised way, in a friendly way, that meant that whoever won would have offered jobs to the other two. And that's precisely what happened. And he knew that he couldn't win at that point. The next best for him was to take a place in the cabinet. He had a huge part in getting rid of the poll tax. So he left his mark, and Major cleverly, because by appointing him deputy, he was taking any possible future rivalry out of the way. And Heseltine enjoyed quite a few years in that role. And it was Major who had to, of course, take the brunt of the 1997 slaughter at the hands of Labour. So Heseltine had I remember going to interview him in this wonderful plush office he had as Deputy Prime Minister. And I remember saying to him, well, you didn't do too badly, did you? And he laughed at that point. So his was a rather classy way of not getting the top job.
Now let's also bring in Katie Balls from The Spectator. Morning, Katie.
Morning.
Now let's assume, as the polling is telling us, that this is the case, and this is certainly the working assumption in both camps, despite the spin, that Rishi Sunak misses out by whatever margin next Monday. What are you hearing about what he's going to do?
So I think the big question, which lots of MPs are asking, is effectively, does he stay in the Commons? And if so, for how long? Now, I think it's clear from Rishi Sunak's comments that he would not have a quick exit. I think he would definitely stay as an MP, or at least the current plan is, at the very least until the next election. I think if you speak to those close to Rishi Sunak, they'll say, oh, no, he'll stay a long time, even after the next election. But lots of people say these things, and as we've just been hearing, when it comes to the history of this, we just need to look at, you know, David Cameron, a few examples to see how people can change their minds. I think in terms of Rishi Sunak's personality, I would be surprised if he is Liz Truss's biggest problem on the backbench. I think a blonde rival, Boris Johnson, is more likely to be problematic, in the sense that Rishi Sunak is quite straight-laced in many ways, and therefore have his interventions, but I can't quite see him right now, at least, having this, you know, power base where you're trying to cause all these problems. I think he will have principles, and that could mean some rebellions and some issues. But for example, this idea that he would have voted down the budget, I don't think that was ever going to happen, because the fact that is a confidence matter, and he does not want to do something which could be look as though you're blowing up a Conservative government.
Yeah, exactly. Whereas, you know, his supporters are wondering aloud, albeit off the record, that they may end up voting against Liz Truss's tax cuts. But as you say, that's a huge step for any MP to take if they want to retain the party whip. And also, we know that he's also said, I'm not going to serve in cabinet, but that needn't necessarily mean that he's going to be causing lots of problems. It might just mean that he sits on the back benches in the Commons occasionally, makes the occasional pointed intervention, but otherwise is very quiet. Just think, looking at Liz Truss's camp, Katie, what sort of role would she envisage for Rishi Sunak, given that, you know, he's already essentially ruled himself out of the cabinet? Is the thinking in Truss's camp now, well, if he doesn't want to serve, we'll make a big show of sacking him?
I don't think there'll be a big show of sacking him, in the sense that I think there was relief in Truss Towers when Rishi Sunak effectively said he would not want to serve in her government, it would be difficult. Because I don't think Liz Truss particularly wants to have Rishi Sunak in her cabinet. It's obviously convention that you are supposed to offer a job, often a senior job. I don't think it was ever going to be a great office of state. And I think now that he's said that I'm not convinced that she will even offer him a job. I think to some, at least around, I think this offers her a way out to say, well, he effectively already has said he doesn't want it, so therefore we don't need to focus on that. I think there are figures, though, who are mindful of the way of not to do these things with too much glee. And so you can have a scorched earth policy. And I think other figures likely to join Rishi Sunak on the backbenches would be Dominic Raab. Mm. The Truss camp really saw red over the piece for the Times, where Dominic Raab said her plans, he likened them to, you know, an electoral suicide note. And so I think there is a sense that they don't want lots of these people in the cabinet, but probably private celebrations and anonymous briefings rather than trying to do anything which is too directly linked to her, where she could be accused of, you know, looking as though it was in bad taste or she was enjoying it.
Well, Phil, you'll obviously remember when Theresa May sacked with some glee, if we're using that word, Katie, very astutely puts her finger on. You know, Theresa May made a great show of sacking George Osborne and Michael Gove in her first day at number 10. And in the end, she was humbled by the electorate in 2017, and Michael Gove came knocking, or rather she came knocking and got Michael Gove to rescue him. So it's not always straightforward when a winner sort of chooses to vanquish their rival, is it?
No, and I, from Sunak's point of view, I think Katie's dead right. He's cleverer than that, and he's young enough to have another go. So, in my opinion, and that of Conservative MPs I've spoken to recently, they think he would be wise to wait and see, to possibly make a decision if Truss is able to turn everything around and look certain to win the election in 2004. I'm sure that you would see Sunak standing down just before the election. Now, we don't think that's very likely. He's certainly can afford to wait until after that election, get himself re-elected. If there's a leadership election at that point, people may judge him on the way Truss has handled matters in the 2 years before the election and on the way he's behaved. So yes, he'll make speeches which will show that he's out of line probably with the Truss leadership, but he won't be, I wouldn't have thought he would be hugely rebellious. I wouldn't see any gain for him in that. Probably his problem has been that he looked too keen this time round. It got out too often that he was sort of making preparations to go for the leadership whenever the opportunity came. And then, you know, he was the one who got blamed for the departure of Boris Johnson when a hell of a lot more other MPs wanted him to go as well. So he may have learned from the experience. We may see a Sunak second coming. Who knows?
Just before I let you both go, Katie, you know Liz Truss. You know Liz Truss well. You know what she's thinking. And it's, of course, it's not over yet. Who knows? There might be a shock come next Monday. And Liz Truss is very keen to avoid looking complacent and looking like she assumes she's got all this in the bag, despite the extensive preparations for government that are going on. Should Liz Truss lose, Katie, if the unlikely happens, what do you think her backbench career would look like?
I'm not sure she would be as well behaved as Rishi Sunak. I think there's also a question in the sense that I imagine she'd be more vocal from the backbenchers. There's also a question there, which is Rishi Sunak, I think, would offer Liz Truss a job. That has been the suggestion. So at that point, does she accept it? She ultimately has been very critical of Rishi Sunak's plans, but she hasn't said they are an electoral suicide, no. So you can perhaps imagine a role where she stays in cabinet but creates a power base. I wouldn't completely rule that out.
Plenty more fizz with Liz.
Exactly. And, you know, waits to see, because I think If there was a big shock in the polling, you'd still imagine it would be, you know, Rishi Sunak's camp. So if we win on 51%. So I think it'd be close enough that it would all feel very unsettled and should probably think, I just hang around and I can have a second go at this.
Well, that's all from me on the podcast today. Matt's back tomorrow with a cracking show. He'll be speaking to Nick Thomas Simmons about his new biography of Harold Wilson. Don't forget to like and subscribe wherever you get your pods from.